Welcome to New Human Living Radio Show, bringing you powerful interviews to awaken the power in you. Learn more at newhumanliving.com. And now your host, Les Jensen.
Hello and welcome to the show tonight. I'm so glad you chose to join us. Talk about powerful interviews. Tonight, the topic is the biology of belief, and our guest is Dr. Bruce Lipton, PhD. You know, I've been thinking about this thoughts and beliefs, which is the topic of tonight's show, and I just have to say I feel truly blessed. I am so excited that this show brings you the kinds of interviews that really gets to the heart of the matter as far as you and me and all of us really honoring our power. And tonight is just that kind of episode. Dr. Bruce Lipton wrote the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter and Miracles. How sweet is that? That will forever change how you think about your own thinking. He brings to light stunning new scientific discoveries about the biochemical effects of the brain's functioning to show that all the cells of your body are affected by your thoughts. It's a delight and a pleasure to have such a wonderful guest. And joining us tonight is Dr. Bruce Lipton, PhD. Welcome to the show, Bruce.
I'm telling you, I'm so excited to be here because I know that you and I have wonderful things to talk about freeing ourselves up and understanding the nature of love and harmony and planetary evolution. So I'm excited, Les, so I hope the audience feels the vibes as well.
Amen. I like that. Well, you know, when you provided some wonderful questions for this interview, and when I just take a step back and look at it, I can really see an evolution of a really beautiful soul. I love the work that you're doing.
Well, for me, Les, the whole idea is that the biology is the science that I grew up with, and midway through my life, I realized as I was teaching the conventional biology to medical students that my research revealed a completely different story than the one I grew up with and the one I was teaching students. And it's an exciting story because it's a story that reveals how powerful we are in creating our lives after teaching students and medical students that we're victims of our heredity, that our genes control our lives. That is completely false. And it's exciting because the new science, which actually has a name called epigenetics, and we'll talk about that, is different from the conventional science genetics. In this way, the conventional science genetics that almost everybody's been programmed with is the belief that genes control us, and therefore our fate is in the hands of the genes that we received at the moment of conception. And why is that important? The importance is this. So that means your fate is predetermined, and you're sort of more or less stuck in this body which has genetics which are going to control it, and then you just sort of follow going, oh, my God. And that was the belief system. You're a victim of your heredity. The new science, epigenetics, is a complete revolution because it's a science that reveals how we control our genetics. And that becomes important because it switches us from the old belief victim to the new belief of mastery. We have mastery over our biology, our health, and our life on this planet. And this is the greatest message at a time when everything seems to be flying out of control. There's, wait a minute, we have power. And that's why I love talking about it.
Well, I really like that. And, you know, even just the sentence, the biology of belief, that word belief seems to be the pinnacle, the fulcrum, if you will, of the outcome. How is it that such a large imprint can happen on a collective consciousness and as far as science and medicine and be so far off of base?
Well, it's interesting because every civilization, and there have been many civilizations, and they come and they go, and we just look at the one we're in like, oh, this is the one that's here, it's always here, I'm part of this civilization. And I go, you know, wait, if you go back there to the days of the Roman period, and you say, yeah, the fall of the Roman civilization, it's like, oh, wow, if you were in Rome, the civilization fell and you were there. The British Empire fell back at the end of World War II, and the U.S. right now has been like the replacement of the British Empire, so it's in truth the U.S. Empire. And you say, what do you mean? I say, well, look, where does the U.S. have its military bases? All over the world, you know, it's not just stuck in the United States, we're global. And the reality is, just as those other civilizations have fallen, this one is about to fall. And then you say, well, what is that that creates the civilization, and what is it that causes it to fall? And it's very interesting, and it goes like this. A population buys into a belief about life, and when the collective large number buy into the same belief, then that belief shapes the culture of that civilization. And I say, well, the previous civilization that fell actually was it was a civilization called monotheism. And monotheism, well, let me list three or four that came and fell. The first one, 10,000 years ago, was called animism. And that was a culture that was characterized by, let's say, Native Americans or First Nation people in Canada, Aborigines in Australia, Indians in South America, or Druids in Europe. And this was a culture that was based on the belief that everything was spiritual. And so the physical world and the spiritual world were united as one. And that's why, like Native Americans, when they're out and they want to hunt a deer, for example, before they hunt a deer, they honor the spirit of the deer. They honor the spiritual element before dealing with the physical element, saying that both of them are tied together. And so that was an interesting time in our world because everything was spiritual, every person was spiritual, every blade of grass was spiritual. And that civilization ended when a new vision came in called polytheism. And we know that through like the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans, many gods. And what they did is they took the spirit out of the individual things and coalesced them into gods. So instead of worshiping the individual deer, for example, there was a god of animals and a goddess of plants. And so they coalesced spirit out of the individual into the gods. And we started to put a little more emphasis on dealing with the gods than on dealing with the things on Earth, actually, and looking, you know, skyward, more or less. And that civilization came to an end when all of the gods were put into one singular god under the name of monotheism. And most interestingly, the spirit that god represents is no longer on the planet. So you go from the days of animism, the Indians, everything was spiritual, blade of glass, drop of water, that was spiritual. And then we get to monotheism. Well, nothing is spiritual, and the spirit that does exist is on some other place, heaven, somewhere in the celestial world is the so-called spirit source. And the earth had lost its spirit. And then, you know, the church was trying to get people to understand, well, the earth is really not where you want to be. You want to go to the spiritual realm where everything is perfect. And that was the belief. And they tried to say, look, the earth is damned. Don't get caught up in the beauty of the earth because that will detract you from your mission of going to heaven.
Oh, my God.
There was a complete change then, you know, from the go back to the animus. Everything that was physical was spiritual. Now everything was physical, not only not spiritual, but it was trouble because if you got involved with the earthly things, that was take you away from your destination, which is not on earth. And then that civilization fell when Charles Darwin gave us a new story about how life was created rather than the Genesis story. When Darwinian theory came in, it was like, oh, it's mechanical. It happened with heredity units, genes, and evolution is physical and mechanical. And what happened then, we entered into a new civilization. And this civilization is based on the belief where science is the truth provider as compared to the previous generation when the church was the truth provider. I always love it because, whoever is guiding us with the truth of our lives, it's not just a source of some truth, but the source of all truth. So when the church was running the world at that time under monotheism, if you had any question about life or anything, the source for your answer was the guy wearing the black coat. And then I said, you know, after Charles Darwin came in and science replaced the church in a spiritual thing and made everything more physical now, yes, life is physical, it's genetic, it's molecules, no spirit involved. Today, we get our answers to questions from the guy wearing the white coat, which is kind of funny, from the black coat to the white coat, because now our source of truth is science. And what has happened is a civilization is formed by beliefs that everybody holds. And then when those beliefs change, civilization changes, accommodates the new beliefs, creates a new culture, and the old one disappears. And it's interesting because the truth providers are the ones that answer three questions. That's all it is. Three questions that are asked, have been asked for 10,000 years by people on this planet. And whoever gives you the answers to those three questions that you buy, that the population buys,
right,
that source of that answer also becomes the truth provider for all other questions about life. And these questions, they have a name. They're called the perennial questions. And as I said, they've been asked for 10,000 years. And the three basic questions are, how did we get here? Why are we here? And how do we make the best of it now that we are here? And when we get a source that gives us an answer to those questions that we like, we make that source the truth provider. So I said, like in the previous generation, the answers to those questions that we got here through divine intervention, we're here, according to the church, to live out plays of morality, to see if we're worthy enough to go to the next place, heaven. And you live by the laws of the Bible. And that's when we made the church truth provider. And if you had a question about anything, health, life, anything, you would go to the priest in the black coat because that was the source of answers. And as I said, that those beliefs changed in 1860 after Darwin because the idea of Genesis gives way to the idea of mutations and evolution and all that stuff, which have no version of spirituality at all. It's all mechanical at this point. And yet the people believe the understanding because it made more sense than the 7 days of adventure where, you know, life was created in 7 days, whatever, from Genesis. People bought into the mutation story, the heredity genetic story over that. And because the answers now were coming from science, then science becomes the truth provider. So in our world today, you say, well, is it true or not? And the answer is, well, is it scientific?
Right.
And that's our judge for true. And I say, well, this is really cool. But then I'm also going to tell you, and here's the exciting part, Les, is that when the answers to the questions change, civilization necessarily changes along with it. And here's the beautiful part. The answers to the three questions, which science has provided the answers, how do we get here? Random mutations. Why are we here? Oh, well, it was an accident because they're called random mutations. So there was no purpose for our being here other than, hey, we're just lucky winners of the genetic toss-up. And how do you make the best of it? Well, that's Charles Darwin's theory of evolution that says life is a struggle for competition among fitness to survive in this struggle. So then that's what our life is. If you look at the world, we have created a civilization that's totally based on struggle and competition, and that's our world today. And guess what? The answers to the questions have changed in the last 30 years. We now know that we didn't get here by random accidental mutations. We got here by more or less, you might refer to them as adaptive mutations, meaning as the environment changes, organisms adapt so that an organism isn't an accident of the environment. It is connected to the environment. And then it says, why are we here? And that's the beautiful part, because every organism on this planet, now we're beginning to realize this now, is that every organism is part of a cooperative. When they say the word garden, the Garden of Eden, for example, in Darwinian terms, you say, oh, the Garden of Eden, that's a struggle for survival with competition for fitness. It's like, a garden is not a struggle zone. A garden is a zone of harmony and balance and working together in cooperation. So I go, wait a minute, the new answers are, hey, we didn't get here by accident. that we got here as part of a community to keep harmony and balance in that environment, and that the way to do it is to live in cooperation with nature. So I say, wow, that's completely different than the idea, oh, we're just here by accident, there's no reason for us to be here, and that life is a struggle. That's what we're living by today. To turn into a world tomorrow that says, wait, we're all here to support the environment and that we're all here to work in cooperation with each other, that's a completely different way of life. And so, interesting point. The answers to those fundamental questions, the perennial questions, have just changed. And history has revealed every time the answers change, the civilization changes to accommodate the new answers.
Right.
So we're like, oh, we're in a transition. What are we finding out? Well, the first thing is we're noticing how we're destroying the environment. We're destroying the environment with human habitation, destroying it so much that science has now recognized the truth that we are now into what is called the sixth mass extinction of life on this planet. From history, it is found that five times in the history of this planet, life was thriving, and then it disappeared. And they you know, try to attribute the loss to things like a comet or asteroid hitting the planet and destroying the environment, or massive geological activity, lots of volcanoes, earthquakes, and things like that destroying life. Previous five, those are the sources of what they say is the cause of the catastrophe. Today, we're losing species of organisms 1,000 times above background, meaning there's always a loss of species. It's a small number. Today, the loss of species is 1,000 times greater than just the background loss, meaning we are accelerating the loss of species. I mean, the numbers are, since 1970, for example, half the animals on this planet are gone. That's an amazing, it's like half the animals on this planet, population 1970, have died because of destruction of the environment by humans.
Wow.
That 90% of the fish in the ocean are gone because of overfishing and destroying the habitats. And all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, we're facing an extinction because of the breakdown of the environment, but the cause of the breakdown of the environment is us. And it's always like, oh my God, we have to change the way we're living on this planet, because the way we're living on this planet is causing our own extinction. So you look at the world, you look at all the chaos, everything is in crisis, economic crisis, social crisis, religious crisis, healthcare crisis, fuel crisis, go on and on and on. And you go, wow, this is really bad. And then I say, well, the good news is in the bad news, meaning we're so out of balance with life and the world and with ourselves that we're pushing to the extinction of life on the planet by our behavior. Well, that means crisis. And I go, yeah, that's the crisis we face. And I said, but crisis is important because crisis causes evolution, meaning, hey, we hit the wall. What are you going to do? You can't keep going this way. You must change and move into a different way. Well, that's the good news. It says, wake up. We can't do this anymore. We have to change. And the, one of the most important changes is, for example, the belief that we live in now is the Darwinian belief that competition is the drive force of evolution. And the new science reveals it's the complete opposite. It's not competition. It's cooperation. A garden is not a battleground. The garden is a zone of harmony. And what have we done to the garden? Turned it into a battleground, the way we're living with competition, only to now realize that humans have to come together in a different relationship now and learn to live with each other in harmony and cooperate in order to bring back the garden that really provides for us. So bad news, good news. Bad news, it's all falling apart. Good news, well, that's the necessary stimulus to cause us to move into the survival mode that humans need to go into. And that's what we're facing right now. So, well, people look out at the world and they're shocked about, oh, my God, my job, my possibility of surviving, the food, all these kind of issues. And I go, yeah, but those negative issues are the ones that will force us to learn how to live in harmony with each other. And that is the positive outcome.
Well, it's people like you that are recognizing that and then bringing forth with your material the language of what that looks like. When you look at the collective, there's a real established pattern of disease, of cancer, of autism and whatnot. And then there's got to be those fringe people that weren't raised in the collective consciousness, weren't fed the ingrained belief systems. Have you seen examples of what the collective wouldn't recognize as far as a possibility?
Well, let's put it this way. When I started to see the science and understand that the evolution was not the story I was teaching medical students, for example, that evolution was not a competition of, genetic accidents once against one against another, that there's an understanding of cooperation, that every human and every, just like the Native Americans, actually going back to that period of animism and recognizing that everything has a spiritual aspect to it. And all of a sudden you say, well, Bruce, that sounds religious. I want to separate spirituality from religion. It's very important. Religion, to me, is the business of spirituality. Spirituality is recognizing that there's more to us than the physical zone that we see and live in, that there's an energy, and that this invisible energy is influencing the physical world in which we live. In fact, quantum physics has introduced the nature of the role of energy and calls the energy the field. And I say, well, what's the definition of the field according to physics? And the answer is, the field represents invisible moving forces that influence the physical world. Quantum physics talks about the energy shaping the physical world. I go, well, you know, that's interesting, because then the definition of quantum physics for the word field turns out to be the exact same definition that ancient people used for spirituality, invisible moving forces that influence the physical world. It's like, yes, quantum physics is going to return us back to a day like with Native Americans lived here in animism, recognizing that every drop of water, every blade of grass, every human is not just a physical structure, but also an energy-based equivalent that we would have in terms in the past used the word spirit. If you don't want to use that word because it doesn't feel right, then say field, which sure is the current quantum physics word as science, and recognizing they represent the same thing. And that becomes important because we left the spirit, the invisible energy, out of our world today as we went into the Darwinian, Newtonian world of a physical, mechanical body and everything is just genes and chemistry. We left the spirit out. And quantum physics is saying, no, wait a minute, you can't leave it out because it's what's shaping the physical world. So it's asking us to return back to a time to honor the spirituality of everything, from grass to people, everything. And this changes then how we would relate to each other in the world.
Well, you know, the idea of energy, or that field, if you will, the listeners have heard me speak before of moments in my past when I would release all this immense amount of power, just raw emotions flowing out of my what had previously been subconscious, below my consciousness. I would tap into this unresolved energy in my psyche and release it. And then I think of the law of attraction. It's like if I just let out 1,000,000 watts of energy that was in my psyche, I had to have had an interaction with the world outside of me related
Absolutely.
To that. So when we talk about, I'd love to hear your take on how the subconscious is a lens, perhaps, in how we experience the world around us.
Well, yeah, this is one of the things that woke me up real early in my scientific career. About 1970, I was cloning stem cells. And just to give people an understanding, a stem cell is the equivalent of an embryonic cell. It's, and all of our bodies as adults are filled with stem cells, embryonic cells, for a reason. And that is, on a day-by-day basis, all of us are losing about several hundred billion, with a B, several hundred billion cells in our bodies die every day. Normal, that's just normal attrition. But the important part we have to understand is to stay alive and to stay healthy, you have to replace hundreds of billions of cells every day, and that's called the stem cells. They're leftover embryonic cells. So even though whatever age you're at, you still have embryonic cells in your body because they have to replace the dying cells that go every day. So I was cloning stem cells, and what that means is simply this. You take one stem cell, put it in a petri dish all by itself, and then it divides every 10 or 12 hours. So first you put one cell in, and then 10 hours later two cells, and 10 hours later four cells, and it doubles, 2, 4, 8, 16. And after a week, my tissue culture dish has about 50,000 cells in it. But the most important understanding was that the 50,000 cells are genetically identical. And I say, okay, now here's the interesting story. In a laboratory, to grow cells in a laboratory, in a culture dish, you grow them in something called culture medium. Cells are like fish. They live in an aqueous environment, a water environment. So when you cut yourself open, fluids leak out because underneath your skin is like an aquarium with all the fluid. And the fluid under your skin is collectively related to blood. So we talk about the blood. And I say, well, if I want to grow cells in a plastic petri dish, then what I do is I go to the source of the cells. So if I'm growing mouse cells, I go to a mouse and look at the composition of the blood. And then I try to make synthetic blood, which is called culture medium. So culture medium is equivalent of synthetic blood. And when I grow human cells, I try to make synthetic human blood. Okay, so here's the point. 50,000 genetically identical cells. I split them up into three petri dishes. But here's what I do. I change the chemistry of my culture medium. In other words, change the chemistry of that synthetic blood a little bit in each of the three dishes, so they're not exactly the same culture medium. And in dish one, my cells form muscle. In dish two, the cells form bone. And in dish three, the cells form fat cells. Well, the most profoundly important question is, well, what controls the fate of the cells? And the first thing we start with is say, wait, they were all genetically identical cells. So the fact was this, I can't start with and say genes caused it to make muscle and genes caused it to make bone. Why? They all had the same genes. So sure. I said, then what was the cause of why one becomes one or the other? And the answer is the chemical composition of the culture medium, which is equivalent to blood. I say, oh my goodness, then the genes don't control the fate of the cells. I go, no, the environment. Is it wherever the cells are growing, that environment controls the fate of the cells. I go, well, why is that important? Well, the first thing is this. The belief that we were living under when I was doing this research is the belief that genes turn on and off and genes control life, and therefore your genes will determine your fate. And that's why people have perceived themselves to be victims of their heredity. If they have cancer genes running in their family, then they feel like, oh, my God, I have cancer genes in my body, and I'm going to get cancer because the genes are going to give me cancer. That's the belief, victim of the genes. The new story that I saw in the petri dish is, wait a minute, if you change the environment, you change the fate of the cells. And I go, well, this is profoundly important because we can change our environment. I go, well, wait a minute, if we can change our environment, then we are controlling ourselves. And I go, yes, we are controlling our own genetics. And this is profoundly different because it says that our lives are not controlled by our genes, but it's controlled by the environment that we respond to and perceive. And since we can change the environment, then we are powerful enough to change our biology. And all of a sudden we go from genetics, which when you say the word genetic control, that's what I was teaching. Genetic control means control by genes. That's the old belief. The new science is called epigenetic control. And you say, well, it sounds like the same thing. I go, yeah, but epi is a revolution because epi means above. So when I say the new science, epigenetic control, I'm literally saying control above the genes. And all of a sudden we say, yeah, but what's above? And I say, your environment and how you respond to your environment. And therefore, those are the factors that determine health. And so all of a sudden, we are not the victims of our genes. We are it's our environment and our perception. And that becomes important because since we can change our environment and change our perception, then we're not victims of our heredity. We become masters. And this is what is needed because too many people believe their lives are out of their control and all of that because of, oh, I got cancer genes in my family. I got, you know, heart disease genes in my family. I got Alzheimer's genes. And they see themselves as, oh, I'm going to have these things because genes are causing them. And I'm going, no, you can change everything, but you have to understand, you have to change how you respond to the world and your environment. And I'm sorry, Wes, and I'm running on it, but if I just finish this, then we'll get to the connection of why the mind is important here.
Sure.
And that is this. I said the cells respond to the chemistry of the culture medium, which is the equivalent of blood. And then I say, well, you know, we're talking about cells in a plastic petri dish and adding culture medium. And I go, you know, here's an interesting point. When you look in the mirror and see yourself and you see one single human looking back, you say, oh, one organism. I look in the mirror, I see Bruce. Yeah, Bruce, one biological organism. I go, a little bit of a misperception for this reason. The body is actually made out of about 50 trillion cells. The cells are the living entity. When I say the word Bruce, that's a term that covers a community of 50 trillion cells. I'm not a single entity. The cells are the living entity. I'm a community. So the funny joke is a human being is covered petri dish with 50 trillion cells inside and culture medium called blood. I go, fine. And then I say, yeah, but the culture medium composition controls the genetics and the behavior. I go, fine. The question is now, what controls the chemistry of your culture medium, the chemistry of your blood? I go, oh, the brain is the chemist. The brain is mixing chemistry to you know, control your blood, your culture medium. And then I go, and here's the last and final question. So what chemistry should the brain add to the blood or regulate the blood with? And then I go, oh, that's based on your mind. Meaning, here's a simple bottom line. You're sitting there, your eyes are closed, you open your eyes, and someone you love is in front of you. Guess what? The interpretation of love in the mind causes the brain to release chemistry that's associated with love, including things such as dopamine, pleasure. So that's why when you see someone you love, you feel pleasure because the brain is releasing dopamine into the culture medium, the blood. You bond to the one that you love because when you see that person you love, your brain releases oxytocin into the culture medium, the blood, and oxytocin is a bonding chemical. When you fall in love, you're healthier and you glow. They always say, look, oh, they're so in love. See how they glow. And one of the reasons is when you're in love, the brain releases growth hormone, which causes the body to become very healthy. So the point is this. The chemistry of the blood was based on the interpretation of love. And I tell you, and here's what the difference is. Same person sitting there, eyes closed, but this time, when they open their eyes, something scares them. I go, first thing, brain is not going to release any of the chemistry of love. That chemistry is not coming out of a brain that perceives fear. When you perceive fear, you put stress hormones into the system. You release inflammatory agents that regulate the immune system. And I go, oh my goodness. Then the culture medium composition changes. The moment you change your mind from love to fear, you change the chemistry. And the chemistry that's released in fear actually does not support our health. As a matter of fact, that's why up to 90% of illness on this planet today is related to stress hormones, which are related to fear. Something's threatening us. And those stress hormones are affecting our immune system because of the secretion of the brain, and our growth and maintenance of those stem cells that we need to repair our bodies every day. Point, simple. Conclusion. The blood is the culture medium for 50 trillion cells in your body. The culture medium composition controls the genetics and the behavior. The composition of your blood is controlled by your mind. Whatever you perceive is going to be translated into chemistry, and that chemistry is going to make your body match what you perceive. So I say, why is this important? And the answer comes down and says, we used to believe our health was controlled by our genes. Now we know our health is really controlled by our perception of the world, our belief about the world in which we're in. Because as we change our beliefs, we change the chemistry, and when we change the chemistry, we change the genetics. And then we say, well, what is the bottom line at this moment? 90% of illness on this planet has nothing to do with genetics. It has everything to do with the way we perceive our lives and the environment in which we live. Point is simple. It's our beliefs and our perceptions that are causing our problems, and yet the resolution is perfect because it says, well, if you want to change it, you don't have to change your body. You just have to change your beliefs and your perceptions, and the body will automatically change. So you could be dying of cancer and have a belief change, and all of a sudden the cancer disappears. We call it spontaneous remission. Some people like to call it a miracle. It's not a miracle. It's absolute science. You change your perception. You change the culture medium. And a culture medium with a different perception can cause the health of the system, or a negative culture medium on negative perceptions can cause sickness. And then all of a sudden you realize we're not victims of anything more than our perception about life. And if we change our perceptions, we can control our life, and therefore we are powerful in regulating our health and life on this planet. That's a long story answer, Les. Sorry.
Hey, no worries. That's what I like about an hour show. We can actually get into the meat and potatoes of it. So I really liked what you said when you open your eyes and you see, and your reaction is love. And that love changes the environment of the cells and erases the signature of dis-ease. So if we look at that with ourselves, that should easily translate also into the collective. So if I'm watching TV or I'm walking through a public place and what I see I don't have a reaction of love to, I'm actually perpetuating the disconnect or the dis-ease.
Absolutely. That's exactly 100%. And this is what led me to my second book called Spontaneous Evolution, because what I recognize is, wait a minute, if beliefs control our health as individuals, the question then was obvious. What about collective beliefs? And I go, then they collectively affect the entire population in the same way, so that our beliefs on our, who we are and what we are and how we live on this planet, collectively, they shape us as individuals, but collectively, all the individuals represent the whole population. So our beliefs change us, the way of life. And that's when I went, go back to the beginning. I said civilization is in a process of change because the beliefs of who we are and how we operate on this planet have changed in the last 30 years scientifically, that we're not, you know, genetic accidents that just happen to coincidentally be here and then are involved with a competition for survival. It turns out, no, we were not accidents. We are part of nature's design. Our design was to bring harmony and balance to the environment, such as the Native Americans and First Nation people in Canada. That was their original belief. They were gardeners in taking care of a garden. And I say, and what happened now? I said, well, we lost the nature of gardener and then became domineering. We were controlling nature. Humans control nature. That was the belief system. And I say, and look what we've done with that. We were powerful enough to create balance, but if we lost the mission, that balance was the destination, and used the power, then we end up where we are today, self-destruction. We are so powerful in influencing the environment and not being aware that we were supposed to create harmony in it. We are now altering the environment to the extent there is no harmony, and the environment is falling apart. The web of life is falling apart, and people don't understand. They say, yeah, but so who cares if there's no tiger? We can go to the zoo and see a tiger, you know, or no rhinoceros left in Africa. We'd go see one in the zoo, and it's sort of like, no, you don't understand that all of these animals were part of a whole web, and that web led to the evolution of humans. Simple point. If you break the web of life, then humans, which are derived from the web of life, cannot survive. And this is why science has now recognized we are facing the sixth mass extinction of life on this planet. And it doesn't mean just the tigers and the rhinoceros is going to be gone. It means that we are challenging our own existence by not living in harmony with the environment around us. And that's the wake-up call that we need to deal with right now.
You know, so often in social media, especially in this political climate in the United States, there is so much deep-seated feelings and emotions that keep coming up in these upheavals, if you will. And I really recognize that people want to change things for the better. They want to be an active part of bringing the suffering to an end and restoring harmony. When when people are participating in a social platform or in a collective story, when they drop into an emotional reaction of hatred or anger or resentment or bitterness, doesn't that, I mean, the flip side would be to look at something you despise or hate and be able to love it. What would you say to people as far as being a vehicle of change for the collective as an individual?
Yeah, I just think the first thing is this. We're looking for harmony. There's two states in the world, harmony and disharmony. That's basically, you know, let's divide it. And I say, well, why is it relevant? And I say, health is related to harmony. Disease is an expression of disharmony. It's simple as that. When you're living in harmony with the world around you, you are a healthy person. And when you're not living in harmony, it manifests as a physical disease in your body. And so basically it says this. When you wake up in the day and you start to participate in the world around us, are you encouraging harmony or are you encouraging disharmony? That's basically where, and I say, what's the difference? I say, encouraging harmony is encouraging evolution and survival. Encouraging disharmony is leading to a breakdown of the system and a loss of health. And that's all we have to look at. And the question, well, what is harmony? And the answer, and this is the fullest sense of harmony, if I put a word, give me a word that means full harmony, love. Love is harmony. Hate is disharmony. Hate causes people to separate from each other. Love brings people together. And the idea is we're in an evolution of civilization that requires us to come together at this point, because the separation of individuals from each other and from nature is the primary cause of the problems that we have as individuals in our personal health and in our global situation regarding the influence on humanity. The disharmony in the world is threatening that existence. So it basically says, well, where's our destination? The answer is love. Love is built into the system. Children are born with love. They only learn to lose it through programming. But it's nature's way. Nature was always bringing harmony in, and since love is a reflection of harmony, that was one of the primary tools of nature, is to have that feeling of love. I mean, animals love their offspring, horses, dogs, cats, whatever you want to talk about. They have their babies. They love their babies. They take care of their babies. We start that way, but then, unfortunately, our programming from the Darwinian point of view, the beliefs that we hold of a struggle and that there are more powerful people and there are weak people and the powerful people get to win and the weak people get to lose, that Darwinian theory, you buy into that, and then the first thing you recognize, you're no longer living in harmony. You're separating people based on the so-called fitness. And the fact is, you know, people are people. And until you recognize all people are part of one organism, and that's what the evolution, there is an evolution that we're engaged in right now. It's not an evolution that changes our biology. You're not going to have different size head and body and all that, like some futurists were thinking, you know, that will change our biology that way. No, our biology is pretty much set. What we're changing is our relationship to each other. What we're learning is the separation that we have lived under for the last few thousand years, where this is your country and this is my country and I'm against your country, you're against my country, and we don't like each other and we have borders and separation. This is preventing our evolution. Our evolution is, as I said, not changing our body, but changing our community. Everything is one community. And when you start to separate communities from each other, then you're separating a whole, and that's when the thing begins to fall apart. We got to bring the whole back together. So the evolution, as I said, not the evolution of the individual. It's the evolution of a new superorganism. And I said, what's that? And I say, called humanity. And each human is the equivalent of a cell in the body of the same organism. And right now, humanity's cells are fighting each other. And when a body has cells that fight each other, it's called autoimmune disease, self-destruction. And guess what? The biggest issues on this planet health-wise are autoimmune disease. we're destroying each other, we're destroying ourselves, because the lesson of harmony and humanity has been lost on this.
Well, I like the idea of love, and that's such a nice segue. So if we take that and we fast forward however far we need to go with our looking glass, how do you envision a world where there is no fear, there is no separation, this superorganism, if you will, the consciousness of humanity, where every single cell, every single persona understands that there's no separation between you and me or nature and myself? How do you see that world? How would you describe that?
I can tell you, because most people have experienced that world out there at some little piece in their life. It may have not been a long time, but almost everybody, after at least being teenagers and getting older in life, have experienced, what would it be like if this harmony existed? And the answer is, what was it like when people fell deeply in love? And I say, why is that important? I say, well, look, consider a person who's not in love. And every day is like, oh, life is a struggle, life is competition, I'm going out there, hitting my head against the wall and doing all this stuff. And then one day they meet this person and they fall in love. I say, guess what? The next day is now totally different than it was all the way up until this moment. All the way up to this moment, life was struggle and strife and fight and do all that. Then you fall in love, and guess what? It's heaven on earth. You're healthy. You're happy. Even your job you didn't like, it's like, it's okay. I can do my job. I'm good and all that. And I go, what happened overnight? Something changed so much that the world was stressed before, and then the next day you're in this, what I call the honeymoon effect. And I say, yeah, but that's when people's lives are glowing, they're healthy, they're happy, everything is wonderful. It's like they can't wait to wake up in the morning and have more beautiful life. And I go, that honeymoon effect, that's what being in love is all about. And I go, you know what? When this evolution occurs, every day is the honeymoon effect. We don't have to have all the strife and all the anxiety and all the aggravation that we have now. We could just all be on a honeymoon, because every day you'd still be doing your work, but guess what? You'd be in love. And when you're in love, everything is healthier and happier and brighter and glows and all that. In the same world that you were in the day before that you weren't in love, wasn't that pretty? And all of a sudden now it's like, oh, it's heaven on earth. So my assumption is the evolution will turn us around to realize that instead of dying and going to heaven, we awaken and find ourselves in heaven, that being on earth is heaven. Being on earth is a place of creation where you can create from your mind. And if everybody's mind was in love, then the creation that we're living in right now would be profoundly different. Same people, same planet, but profoundly different experience. And that's our destination, evolution of love. Love to recognize that every human is a cell in the same body. And that if you fight another cell, you're fighting yourself, and that will destroy the health, harmony, and the love. And that's what our lesson is right now, Les. I think that's what we're working toward.
You know, Hollywood has portrayed that idea of love, falling in love, and the characters typically, after spending time in that space of love, they're so gleeful, they're joyful, they're running, they're dancing, they're dreaming of all the possibilities of the future. And it's such a euphoric persona, if you will. It, to me, when I look at nature, without the effect of the human discord, there's such a grace to it. I mean, it's so eloquent. It's just elegance personified. And when I see so much stress in humanity, it's like that's the elixir. That's the thing that'll flip this over when we let go of the stress, when we let go of trying to drive it or force it through that control, that mind space, and we open our heart and connect with each other, as you say, in that honeymoon effect. That sounds like a euphoric, joyful place to live, which really sounds like heaven on earth, like you've been talking about.
Well, yeah, and as I said, this is not a novel idea, because as most people out there in our listening audience at some time have felt that. The honeymoon may have not lasted very long, but if I just say go back to where it was working, if it was just a week, fine. Go back to that time and just say, how was life? And all of a sudden, everything we just talked about is like, yeah, it was great. I go, yeah, but if everybody woke up like that tomorrow morning, then this world will be completely different. That the war and the violence and the antagonism and all that would disappear. And then we'd return back to the garden again, harmony among everything. And that we're being called to do that, because the disharmony that we have been sowing is now coming back. It hit us in the face as mass extinction. It says, you cannot do this anymore. If you continue what you are doing, you will not be here anymore. And that is what science has come to verify. It's not a suggestion. It's a scientific reality. We are in this extinction phase right now, with the lesson saying, wake up. And if you wake up, you'll have more opportunity here. And if you don't wake up, okay, enjoy the last days. It's on its way out.
So the pacing is really on the table. Whether it takes a long time or a short period of time, the quantum field really doesn't care. It'll just mirror back to us whatever we conjure up. And so to me, it really reflects the power of the individual to transcend their own personal stigma and to be able to choose that love, to choose that grace, and erase the division between us, and that ultimately will decide how the collective shifts as well.
Yeah, no, but we have to recognize something. Let's put in, where is the crux of the problem? If you said, Bruce, tell me where exactly the crux of the problem is, I would say, here's where it is. I said the mind and its image is translated into chemistry by the brain, and that chemistry goes in the blood, and that chemistry selects our genetics and our life. And I go, well, the mind, and here's the critical part. There are two parts to the mind. And we talk about the mind as if it's a one thing. And it's like, no, there are two interdependent parts, meaning two parts that work together to create the mind. And they're very different in how they function, and especially in how they learn. When we don't understand that duality, then we're lost, because it's like, well, how come you're not just thinking happy thoughts all the time? And I go, because the two minds work separately. So if you understand this, then you're going to see where the crux of the problem comes from. And it goes like this. The two minds, if we want to identify them conventionally, one is the conscious mind and one is called the subconscious mind. The subconscious mind is about 90% of the brain and was there before the evolution of the conscious mind. Conscious mind is the latest evolution of the nervous system. So I say, well, what's the subconscious mind? I say, it's a habit mind. It's the mind where we do things by reflex without thinking about it. It's a learning mind, but it also then becomes a habit mind. I'll give you an example. When you were an infant, you didn't know how to walk, and you went through a period of learning how to walk, stand up, stay in balance, and not fall down. Well, what's interesting is, well, now the subconscious mind learned that. And I say, why is it relevant? Because you never have to learn it again. The subconscious mind has habits. I have a habit of walking. And I don't even have to say to myself, Bruce, walk from the living room into the kitchen. I just have to, oh, I want something in the kitchen. I will automatically walk into the kitchen. Beautiful. Subconscious mind's great. When the habits are good, it's great, okay? And then I go, that's the habit mind, and it learns by life experiences. Then I say, and the conscious mind is the latest evolution, and the conscious mind is connected to us as individuals, our spiritual source, our base, who we are as unique individuals. There's something associated with the conscious mind. So if I would just, jokingly say, where am I? Where are you as an individual? Oh, we're in the conscious mind, and it's like behind the dashboard of a car with a steering wheel. And the conscious mind has is a creative mind as compared to the subconscious mind, which is the habit mind. And I go, what's unique about that? Well, I say, tell me what you want from your life, Les. And whatever answer you give me, by definition, came from the conscious mind. It's creative. It's thinking about what it would like. I go, well, good. When the conscious mind is driving the vehicle, when the conscious mind's got its hands on the wheel, then we're driving toward wishes and desires. I want to be healthy. I want to be happy. I want to have a great relationship. Conscious mind, creative wish, that's what it wants. And I go, okay, now here's the problem. The conscious mind can think. And when it does think, it's not paying attention. So, you know, I ask you a question, Les. I say, so tell me, what are you doing Monday afternoon at 4 o'clock? If you actually try to answer that question, where's the answer? It's not outside. The answer is inside. So if you answer the question, what are you doing at 4 o'clock on Monday afternoon, you're not looking at the world at that moment. You're inside your head like a fake Rolodex in there looking at your calendar trying to tell me what's happening. I go, well, here's what's important. If you're driving the car and all of a sudden your conscious mind lets go of paying attention because now it's seeking an answer, does that mean that you stop the car or the car hits a tree or something like that? I said, no. The car is still driving. If you're walking and you're having a thought, you don't stop. I say, well, then who's controlling the driving? Who's controlling the walking when I'm thinking? And I go, here's the answer. The moment the conscious mind is in thought, the subconscious programs take over. So subconscious knows how to walk. Subconscious knows how to drive. These are habits. So no problem. I can think and walk and drive the car, whatever, while I'm thinking. Okay, so that when the conscious mind is busy thinking, the program is run by the subconscious. Now comes the problem. Science has revealed that our minds are in thought about 95% of the time. I go, well, what does that mean? I say, well, then your life is only 5% coming from the conscious mind, wishes and desires. But 95% of your life is coming from the habits, the programs. And then I go, and this is the monkey wrench. The fundamental programs of behavior in the subconscious mind were downloaded by observing your parents, your family, and your community in the first 7 years of your life. The behaviors that are in your subconscious mind were actually recording of other people's, like your father, your mother, your family, their behavior. So when you switch into the subconscious for control, if the conscious mind is thinking, the fundamental programs that are playing are not your wishes and your desires and what you want from life. They're what you learned from your mother, your father, your family, and your community. And the idea is, psychologists will tell you, 70% of the things that we learn are disempowering, they're negative, they're self-sabotaging. And I say, wait it. And that means that 95% of the day, I'm not going toward my wishes and desires. 95% of the day, because I'm thinking, I'm playing these negative behaviors. And then you might say, yeah, but I would see those negative behaviors if I was playing them. I go, no, you see, you were thinking. When you were thinking and the behavior was playing, you're the one that doesn't see the behavior. Everyone else does, but you don't. So I tell this story in the lecture, and people laugh, and I say, because it's such a generally accepted understanding, I say, this is the most profound story, and it goes like this. I'm sure when you were growing up, you had a friend. You knew your friend's behavior very, very well, and you happen to know your friend's parent. And one day you see that your friend has the exact same behavior as their parents. So you get all excited by making the connection. You say, hey, you know, Bill, you're just like your dad. And then you back away from Bill because Bill goes totally ballistic. How can you compare me to my dad? And everybody laughs to a certain degree because they have experience. I go, well, it's the most profound story in the world. For what reason? Everyone else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. The only one who doesn't see it is Bill. I say, well, here's how it works. He downloaded the behavior from his dad in the first 7 years. He plays that behavior when? When he's thinking and not paying attention. So the behavior that he's playing, that he learned from his father, is not observed by him, but it's observed by everybody else. And I go, what's the relevance? I say, we are all Bill. 95% of our lives are not coming from our wishes and desires. They're coming from the programs that we got from others, which are mainly disempowering. So it says 95% of the day, you're not moving in the direction of your wishes and desires. You're moving in the direction of your program. And since most of that is negative, then we wake up in the morning and figure out, listen, I wanted to be healthy. I had a great desire to be happy. I had the, you know, a special desire to get a good job. And none of these things are happening in my life. So it's not me where the problem is coming from, because I want all these positive things are not happening, so the universe is against me. Ah, we all of a sudden see ourselves as victims. victims because we didn't want this negative stuff, and then we got it. And so we said, we didn't do it because we wanted positive things, and we got all the negative things. And I'm going, oh, my God, the negative behavior that caused our problems, we played it. But we were the ones that didn't see it because it was automatic. So we look at the world and say, oh, we're victims because it's not what I wanted. It's not my heaven on earth. And then it turns out is, yeah, but it wasn't the universe that was against you. It was 95% of the day you are playing these programs that psychologists tell us are negative and self-disempowering. But when we play them, it's invisible. So we did not even see that we were causing our problem. And when people understand this, that most of their behavior is invisible and most of it is programmed by other people, when they have knowledge of this, knowledge is power. When they have knowledge of this, then they have an opportunity to change their lives and take the power back, because they're thinking right now that they're not shaping their lives because it's not turning out the way they want. And they're just miss the fact is they are shaping their lives, but not with their conscious wishes and desires, but with their subconscious program. And when we understand this, then we have an opportunity to say, wait, I want to change the subconscious because it's not helping me. Most of our subconscious programs are negative and disempowering. And if we change those programs, which we can, then it says, and here's the beautiful part, what if I replace the negative programs in my subconscious with positive programs? And the answer is simple. Then whether I'm paying attention or I'm not paying attention, I will still be living it to my highest, desire. Because if I default to the subconscious, oh, it's going to now play the programs that I want, wishes and desires, rather than the ones I was downloaded with. And when I'm paying attention, I've got my hands on the wheel, I'm driving it toward my desires and intentions. And if I start thinking, my autopilot subconscious will continue to drive me that way. And all of a sudden, my life will be profoundly different. To do that, it's not to change the world. To do that is to change ourselves. And that's what the evolution is calling upon. You have to look at yourself and say, but the negative things that are happening are not things happening to me as much as things that I'm unconsciously creating. And if I change that, I can have a different life. And that's the destination we're looking for.
So we all have the best seat in the house as far as the point of change. You know, time goes by pretty fast. It's been such a delight having you on the show. I want to make sure our audience can get in touch with you and your material. Can you share with us your web page?
Simple, Les. Thank you. The website is straightforward, brucelipton.com. And on that website are lots of free articles, videos, audios of the stuff that we're talking about. They can access them freely on the website and expand on what we've been talking about. And so there's a lot of information on brucelipton.com.
I want to thank you. It's been such a delight and a pleasure having you on the show tonight. I so appreciate it.
Well, Les, I appreciate it too, because each one of us begins to wake up. Each one of us is contributing to that new heaven on earth reality. That is our potential. I don't know if we're ever going to make it because it's a toss-up. We're facing extinction, but we could also face complete resolution. Just depends how many people decide to take back power over their lives. And that's why I want to thank you for giving me an opportunity to let people know that they're really more powerful than they think they are. It's the invisible subconscious mind that is undermining. And since we can change that, then we are indeed very powerful people, because we can have a honeymoon effect every day of our lives for as long as we live. And I highly recommend it because it is exciting to live that way.
Well, very nice. Well, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Les, and I appreciate you and your audience, and thank everybody out there. Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Bruce Lipton, author of Biology of Beliefs. And what I really like is his background is biology, and it brought him to what we were just been talking about, the subconscious. And my background, my soul put me in front of television transmitters to talk about power. And when we talk about the subconscious from a place of power, and my experience has been with television transmitters, really one-on-one power, the creation of power, the manipulation and transmission. When we talk about that subconscious space, there's an energetic component to that. When you think about, we've been talking about how, when you go to make change, your subconscious is that momentum that carries you in a consistent pattern reaction, if you will, subconscious patterning. You can think of like a super tanker or an oil tanker, a great big boat on the ocean, and there's so much mass to it. Or we could use the term, so much of my personal power has been pushed into my subconscious. When we have patterned thoughts in our subconscious, those don't sit there dormant. They are literally energetically broadcasting the pattern of the subconscious imprinting, and the law of attraction gladly brings to us what our ego might call a scoundrel or a villain, but in truth, they are teachers to show us that aspect of ourself that we haven't resolved. When we talk about a subconscious momentum, there's a karmic signature to it. And if we were to sit down and journal the nature of our life, we would be describing what life would look like from our karmic perspective. And you can think of it as a unique and personal lens that we all have. But if I take that super tanker and I start unloading that energy, unloading that power, literally removing power from my subconscious, there's an energetic release that happens with that. So when you look out at humanity, every single aspect of humanity that gets you upset, what's being upset in you is unresolved energy, unresolved consciousness in your own subconscious. So every aspect of humanity that you find frustrating is a reflection of creation that you're not in harmony with. Now, we can look at the news or social media and see a lot of atrocities and say, well, what the hell? How am I supposed to be in harmony with that? That is just plain, it's terrible. It's an atrocious behavior of our collective story. Well, that's right, it is. And those people that are playing that out have loaded up their own subconscious energy with so much disconnect, dis-ease, so much fearful and hateful energy that they attract other people in that same arena, and they play it out as war and violence, and that's what we're seeing. So when we look at ourselves like you, like me, and we're having this human experience, you have a body, I have a body, I have this consciousness, and I have my subconscious, what can we do as an individual to be a powerful fulcrum of change for the collective? Well, there's a very curious aspect about human consciousness in the fact that it's logarithmic, it's exponential, which means if you change your consciousness a little, your ability to create change in the collective goes up, and it goes up a lot. If I think of that super tanker and I'm throwing cargo off the side, I'm getting more and more agile with my energy, and I'm collapsing the energy radiating from my subconscious that was a mirror of the fear and the disconnect that my subconscious patterning was creating. So every single one of us is an extremely powerful person. I like what Jesus said. Hey, come on now, belly up to the bar. You guys are going to do everything I have done, and you're going to do more. And right there, somebody in the know says, hey, we're all wired for this power, this inherent power in us. But if our power has been pushed into our subconscious, then we create a karmic momentum just like a big super tanker, and we feel like our life doesn't change very fast. Well, I've been doing the law of attraction for a decade now, and not much has changed. If you don't literally remove the energy, and I'm talking energy, in your subconscious, it stays there and radiates as the law of attraction going, hello, hello, I have some self-doubt, and I have some anger, and I have, and these angry people show up in your life, and these people as martyrs, as villains show up to, so you can play the martyr role. It's very, very elegant. The laws of karma are so beautiful. They're so perfect that there's an exquisite grace to it. I love what Rumi said. The profane, the terrible, the profane becomes sacred again, because in fact it is all creation personified. So you have the ability to be a powerful player in this most dynamic chapter of our human story. You can show up in a powerful way. And the way you do that is to unload your karmic cargo, to whittle down that karmic mass, that karmic momentum within your psyche, and get yourself down to a jet ski where, and the ego, when you've shed your karma, we've been talking about how the karma, how the subconscious, more or less the same thing, how your subconscious can constitute 95% of your persona, 95% of your energy, 95% of your power. As you resolve that and release it, all that energy that you're releasing out of your subconscious comes into a conscious space. It's like an iceberg where the majority of you of your energy is subconscious or submerged, and as you melt the ice, pretty soon there's no mass to it, there's no inertia to it. And the really beautiful thing from an ego's point of view is, as you release that karmic impression in your subconscious, your soul shows up in your everyday thoughts, feelings, and actions. And let me tell you what, from your ego's perspective, when you become lucid, when you become empty of karmic momentum, you're literally loosening up the portal of expression your soul has to express through you. So let's use another example. Say you're a painter. Let's put some lead weights on your wrist, and let's put some thick welding gloves on your hands, and let's get a brush the size of a basketball, and then have you paint postage stamps. Well, it's not going to happen. You're going to do this clunk, clunk, smack stuff because you have no dexterity. In other words, if so much of your energy is tied up in your karma, your soul doesn't have the ability to express through you freely without restriction. So as you literally release the energy in your own psyche, you're moving into harmony with your soul's desire for your life. Before you were even born, your soul looked at possibilities. And in this chapter of our human story, there are very powerful and dynamic possibilities of what can happen in a human lifetime, like your lifetime now. And when you take off those gloves and take off those weights and get a finer brush, your soul has more agility. Your soul has the ability to feed you ideas in every moment throughout the day. And since you have no karmic momentum, no karmic propensity, you're agile like a jet ski, and you can pivot and turn at will based on the inspiration of your soul. Wow. That changes everything. It takes practice. I mean, we can talk about this, but boy howdy, for your soul to trust the vision and the power of your heart untethered is a very powerful thing to do, because Most of us live in our ego, and we don't give our heart and our soul's inspiration a second thought. We don't give it an opportunity to land as an action, as a choice in our day. Not even once. But as you shed that cargo, as you shed that karma, and you release the energy from your subconscious, you're no longer attracting villains and scoundrels to teach you incongruencies of yourself because you've resolved them. You're literally empty. You're literally lucid. And so your soul can feed you inspiration by the minute. Your soul can inspire you 1,000 times a day. And if your ego trusts that inspiration, you can take 1,000 unique choices every single day. For most of us on this planet, they don't give their heart and their soul a single choice in the day. They're staring at their flipping phones. They're wondering how they can get more internet connection speeds so they can watch more social media videos. There's no place for the soul to land, to inspire, to influence action in a whole day, let alone an hour or a minute or a second. So as you want to be a powerful player, this is a wonderful time to be alive. Karmically speaking, we're not going to have another opportunity like we have in this lifetime now. The very next lifetime, the karmic equation of this planet will have healed. Well, what do I mean healed and karmic opportunity? How do those two go together? Your opportunity to be powerful is directly proportional to how far into the darkness the collective has gone. If the collective were all flipping angels stuck in love and peace and harmony and joy like some 60s hippies concert like Woodstock, there would be nothing to heal. There would be nothing to transcend. There would be no power in seeing a vision of the truth. But that's not the life you're living right now. You're living in a collective consciousness where we're chopping each other's noggins off and we're poisoning each other and we're exploiting each other and we're financially leveraging people out of their houses. Are you kidding me? So karmically, we've loaded ourselves up to the teeth, and that in itself is an opportunity to be powerful that doesn't exist when you know the truth of who you are, when everyone in the collective knows the truth of who they are. This is a very exciting, very powerful time to be alive. And you're a human being. You got a body. If you got a body, you got a ticket. You're here to find out what's possible in our human condition. You want to play large? You want to show up? You want to give your soul an untethered access to your thoughts, feelings, and choices every day? Wow. You get a taste of that. You get a taste of that, and there's no turning back. I don't want to ever tell my soul no. I don't want to ever tell my heart no. Sometimes my ego trembles because the ideas are so flippin' powerful. But hell, I want to know what's possible in a single human lifetime. And this lifetime here is an exceptional opportunity because we're talking about the entire span of human consciousness to go from the very edge of darkness, the very edge of the collective not understanding who they are, and then all the way back to the light. That's the totality of genres available in a human condition, period. This won't be available in the next lifetime or the lifetime after that. Thrust in your sickle. Pick up your sword of love. Love. Because power is cleaning out your subconscious, cleaning out the energy in your subconscious so it has no momentum. It has no law of attraction related to the past. To have your ego slow down. No, I mean really slow down and just be still. That's where meditation can really help you out. When your ego can just be still in the moment, it is set free. Well, what do you mean? There's no conscious choice or thought pattern. Exactly. When you can slow your ego down and have it be still and be present in the moment, what needs to happen in the moment is inspired in the moment, and your ego slowed down enough to recognize it as in the moment inspiration, and then your ego can take action on it. Well, wait a minute. A still, a quiet ego is a powerful ego? Oh my God. That is giving your heart and your soul full access to your consciousness, full access to your human persona. And then there's this consequence of forgiveness and compassion, and that's self-love. Love of self, and you can't learn to love yourself and then turn around and look at humanity and see anything but love either. There's only one source of power, period, ever, and that's divine love. But if your subconscious is loaded up with energy that hasn't resolved, you're attracting anything but love to you as scoundrels, as teachers to show you incongruencies within yourself. But you clean that stuff out and purify your heart. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall know God. Another word for God could be creation. The pure in heart to know the power of creation, and an ego able to be still and let the moment express its divinity, to be still and let the power and the wisdom of the soul guide you through every day. There's such an immense freedom to the ego when you can do that, because the ego doesn't have to figure it out. The ego doesn't have to calculate anything as far as the path through life. Well, sure, you have to show up and be responsible. You can't go play in traffic and not get road rash. The ego has some collective and social boundaries to behave in, but I tell you what, you're hardwired. You have in you, as divine truth, the perfect chemistry for a most fantastic life. Your divinity is untouchable by human intention. Your powerful storyline for your life is always available for you to desire, embody, and fulfill. Life is such an exciting thing when you can show up for it. Your soul can take you places your ego can't even comprehend. There's this consequence to the ego that is so satisfying. If you stay in your ego all day long and you don't give your heart and your soul any foothold in your day, you will never feel satisfaction and fulfillment like it is possible. But I tell you what, if you can cleanse the energy out of your subconscious and love your ego like your inner child and teach it that it's precious and beautiful and adoring and such a beautiful expression of divine possibilities, and have your ego slow down and relax, your ego will experience oceans of joy as you increment up from the darkness to the light. We talked about human consciousness being exponential. It's a logarithmic power. Every single time you move a notch up that ladder, your ego experiences that as joy, because your heart and your soul are fulfilling your life purpose. And so your heart and your soul are satisfied. your heart and your soul are satisfied. So when you go to bed at night, your heart and your soul are going, damn, what a day. That was fantastic. And your ego's going, that was so much joy. Crap, I get another day to do this? Are you kidding me? Sign me up. So when you honor the purpose of your life and you hone the ability to show passion through your heart and you teach your ego to trust and slow down and just be still, then you are power personified. There's at that point, there's nothing in your subconscious contrary to love. There's no patterning to your thoughts, feelings, and actions. There's no patterning. So your heart and soul have access to every moment of choice, every moment of action. And that is the place of personal power personified. And that's you. That's you living your life purpose. That's you fulfilling the vision of your soul. That's you expressing the passion of your heart. Oh, my God. Oh, my God personified. The Father and I are one. The kingdom of heaven is within. The only day you'll ever experience heaven is today. Unconditional love is the doorway to heaven. That's the portal of divinity personified through you as you into this physical realm. How good can you stand it? How bold can you play? Life is such an exciting and wonderful adventure when you can show up for it. And I suggest if you're here now listening to this, that's just what your heart and soul had in mind. My heart and soul says, love humanity. Show them how to be a vessel of love. Show them how to heal their subconscious. Show them how to purify their energy and to tap that personal power. If there's anything I know on this planet, it's flipping power. Spending 3 decades making big-ass television transmitters, you push the go button, the glycol pumps come on, the blowers come on, and the power meter moves up to 100%, and 1 million flipping watts are screaming out the antenna so Joe Public can watch television. It took me a long time to wrap my noggin around what the hell's this power that I'm creating. I can't see it. I can't touch it. I can't smell it. Can't taste it. What's this divine love in me? What's this God persona in me? Oh, we're all one. We're all God. Whoop-de-doo. If I can't put a flipping fulcrum on that, if I can't get access to a tangible way that can show up and change my life, it's just chit-chat. Whoop-de-doo. I might as well go sit in the podium and listen to somebody yak once a week in something called a church. No. The kingdom of heaven is within you now. It always is. The truth of you is untouchable. Your divinity is waiting for your desire to embody it. It cannot be destroyed, ever. Human intention can't even get close to it. And it's waiting for you in this moment, and this moment, and this moment now. And when you can show up for yourself, damn, life gets exciting. Well, what the hell? Where do I start? Well, you know, what if I told you it was really simple steps? I've heard so many gurus say so many powerful things, and people read the powerful things, then they put the book down, and they don't change anything in their life. I wrote a book, Personal Power Fundamentals, and it is a very simple description about how we take on energy in our subconscious, and then how we can release energy. It took you lifetimes to load up your subconscious. You think you're going to get rid of it on a weekend seminar? No. But I can teach you really simple principles that can give your mind an idea of how it comes in and how you can get rid of it, how you can karmically cleanse yourself. And then when you actually show up, we can talk about exercise all you want, but until you exercise, nothing changes. We can talk about karma all you want, but until you choose to bring it into your life as a practice, it's just talk. I'm here for powerful people. You want to be powerful? I can help you with that. You want to have a fantastic life? I can help you with that too. You know, it's my good pleasure to have spent this time with you now. Until next time.
This has been a New Human Living radio broadcast. You can raise your own personal power with Personal Power Fundamentals Home Study Course at newhumanliving.com. Thanks for listening.